So on the show today, I spoke with James P. Dowling, who is a really, really interesting character. He's a young man. He's the other half of the Iron Lecture series on the Uberboyo channel. He's really into his Jung. He's really into his Nietzsche. He's obviously a big overachiever. Officially, he's a depth psychologist. He's a molecular biologist and he's the director of IPSA Global. He's one of the three people, including Stephen Pauline, who are running the Jung to Live By channel. Basically just serving up some of the best Jungian content that's available on the internet. So I had the really pleasurable, quite frankly, experience of talking to him today. And I'm someone who's been a boyo and watched all the Uber boyo stuff for quite a long time. And James, what he can do is take really fucking high resolution ideas and kind of explain them for regular people like me to understand. And he did that again in this chat, which is really, really cool. We went down an early tangent, which I just quite frankly didn't really know anything about and was quite unprepared for. But I think we really hit our groove at around the 30-minute mark. You know, I wanted to speak with James about Jung and Nietzsche and Harry Potter and the archetypes. We ended up speaking a lot about Jordan Peterson. We spoke about the anima. I think James got a chance to sort of speak about more what he's into these days, which is the psychology part of Jung and not just the really fun sort of social aspect and implications of the Jung and Nietzsche work. He was as erudite as you would expect, as erudite as usual, and he really dropped a lot of amazing insights for me, and I'm sure for you as well, if you're listening. I'm extremely bullish on Jung to Live By, and I really encourage you guys to check that if you're just passively interested in Carl Jung, then this would be a good way to take that step beyond the passive interest. And then also go out and check his Ion series on the Uberboyo YouTube channel as well. Him and his beautiful Irish counterpart, old Stephen, they put together some amazing stuff over there. Okay, no more babble from me. This is the chat with James P. Dowling. Yes, Mr. Dowling, James, super stoked to have you on the show. Thank you so much.
No, my absolute pleasure, my friend. Thank you very much for the invitation.
Thank you. So I have a bit of a skeleton of like a framework, like how I'd try and work through the conversation, but naturally doesn't necessarily go that way. But however, I just want to start with this. So with your terrific summary of Ion, which, separately was like 25, 2-3 hour episode, a ridiculous deep dive into a book, but you gave it an hour summary right at the end. And I was thinking to myself, where the fuck did James differ in the paths of development from all the rest of the English lads who were just worshiping pints and the god of the Premier League? How is this 22, because I think you were 22 at the time, 22-year-old, synthesizing these fucking high resolution ideas, and it seems to just flow as well. It was just very impressive. In your development, what took you down this intellectual path versus the regular sort of herd path?
Well, if you're talking about pints in Premier League, I'm a fan of that when it's around the time of the World Cup, but not normally. It's not normally my go-to thing. I've always been an intellectual of that kind, just out of interest. You know, I was going down a science path, biology, chemistry, physics, math, that kind of stuff in school. And I always did very well in those things and I enjoyed it. And then university, I did biochemistry. And then I did a master's, which was, you know, cell biology, but by research. And then I was in a PhD at the time that the Ion series was recorded. And that was again in biochemistry. But a few things slotted into place over the course of, you know, since I was about 18 or so, that really got me more interested in not necessarily just biology. You know, it was more like, what is the human experience? What makes a human being a human being? Mm. And some of those things that aligned, I've spoken about several times on the channel, but is, you know, if you want to use an Ion metaphor, if you like, the stars aligned. And so I'd say that the biggest influence in terms of putting me on that path in the first place would have been Jordan Peterson. I've since diverted down with my most recent work with Stephen Pauline, my mentors on the Jung to Live By channel, down towards the psychosystems analysis model. And of course, since the Ion series, I've now become a depth psychologist, hypnotherapist, psychotherapist, which is, you know, incredibly humbling, you know, how the internet can start to change these kind of things. But it was just, I think lots of people had it, and I think this is what Peterson, one of the things he legitimately serves as a role within the culture, is that kind of gatekeeper or initiation figure. He's right. like a psychopomp in many ways that can lead people down into their own unconscious minds. And, you know, that's where the Boyo phenomenon came from. Like, we didn't know this existed. You know, we didn't know it existed. And I guess I just was wild enough or crazy enough that I wanted to take the initiative and create YouTube videos on that kind of stuff. And of course, that's when I met Stefan as well around that time. And, you know, it just blossomed from there. We just decided we were going to record one video on Ion because it was cool. And then that just took off. We're like, okay. And then it kept taking off. Well, exactly. It just kept carrying on and carrying on. And it was like, that's very strange. It's a very, really strange thing. But Boyo seemed to have become its own word that resonated with a lot of people. So, of course, when that happens, as a depth psychologist, you might ask, well, what does this represent? You know, and there are several things that it represents. Okay, but to avoid getting too tangential, you know, it was just, I'm interested in the human experience. Okay, if we're going to go, like, what is a Boyo? If I can ask you that, bring you in. What is a Boyo?
What is Boyo? I suppose it's another one of these sort of, another tribe for people to latch onto. Because Boyo is separated enough from the politics that it doesn't, although it is more associated with a certain type of politics, it's separated enough that you can get behind the Boyo with a lot of enthusiasm. It's like a social thing, the Boyo. It's talking about, and it's also, you're talking a little bit about feelings, and I would presume the Boyos are mostly males as well. And that's something that is not easily addressed. But when you enter the discussion of feelings and what do I care about and what's actually going to make me happy, and you enter it through the prism of semen retention versus don't masturbate all the time and porn, all of a sudden it becomes quite accessible. But I mean, I suppose the Boyo it's an online tribe. I mean, something that thought of as you were talking was, you recorded this video with Stefan and you were like, what the hell? There's a lot of people out there that are interested in this. And I'm sure yourself, myself, a lot of people have this experience where they might be interested in this guy, Carl Jung or Friedrich Nietzsche, but in their own immediate community, no one could give a fuck, not one fuck. But the brilliance of the internet is that you all of a sudden can pick from the testing pool of 7 billion versus your immediate 100, 200 people around you. And naturally, you know, you found, I mean, the Uber Boyo channel is 30, 40K subscribed. There's definitely a lot more out there. These are probably just people in English speaking Western countries, but very interesting. I'm not sure if I even answered what you were saying there, but
because you know, it's one of those questions that's open for debate. It's like, well, what the hell is it? There's now thousands of people who resonate strongly with this idea of being a Boyo, so that's strange. But the
language is perfect too. That's the other thing, the Boyo, you know, you can't underestimate just how brilliant that is from a marketing perspective, if you will, you know.
I still remember how that term came about as well. It's probably not a story I can share publicly. It's myself and Stefan and a few other people, but it was really funny. It was really strange. Yeah. We're like, let's just go with Boyo from now on. But you mentioned like masturbation and semen retention and stuff like that. Because that's one of the things that's also involved with it. It's not just Jung and Nietzsche. It's like, you've got to bring all the data points in and then look at it and be, what the hell is this? And it's something like, if you want to use like archetypal language, it's something like it's not just a lost young man. It's the lost young man with high potential and skews towards a certain personality type and has probably been influenced by Jordan Peterson. So you got one of the big problems, of course, of this age. And I think, you know, people in our spheres will agree with this unanimously, is like there's an issue of masculinity. And we're not entirely sure necessarily where that comes from. Well, there's absent fathers, overprotective mothers, the current culture at the moment, which mimics an overprotective mother. There's loads of these things. And you've got young men who don't know how to be men anymore, but instinctually, regardless of any idea that you have, instinctually, you have a drive to be a man and whatever that might mean, but the instinct needs to come out of you. So for a Boyo, it's like we were, or all of us, or the general pattern, is you're a lost young man. And then Jordan Peterson comes along and goes, I initiate you. It's right. like a pseudo father. Potentially a father transference, if you want to be more clinical about it, onto this guy. But then, of course, Peterson disappeared around the time that the Boyos came on the scene.
Uh-huh.
And so they're like, well, what do we do now? And then the boyos come out like, well, we're boyos. Let's go and explore. It's if you look at there's this fourth stage of lifespan development, and we use it clinically with IPSA all the time. When you're born, you go towards your mother. Like, there's like an attachment to the mother. She's meant to protect you. And then you naturally move on to the father if things are healthy and they go well. And then the father's meant to confirm you as a man. Mm-hmm. Then you move on to a peer group, where within that peer group, you're all confirming each other. You're all looking after each other. Then you can go forward and get yourself a girl. That's the healthy way things tend to go. And of course, in the modern era, we've got problems all over the place in that schema. Yeah. So it's as if you look at it like that, Peterson goes, you guys have got some potential and here's loads of ideas, and the boyos get initiated. But it's like they get stuck in the friend stage and they're all looking for something. All the boyos are trying to solve a problem. I think that's what the point of it is we're all looking for who we are meant to become.
Yeah.
We're going to be lads about it and explore our own psyches with each other and see how well that works out. And, you know, I've since departed from that landscape and moved on to form IPSA with Stephen Pauline Richards.
Yeah.
And, you know, looking back on it, it's like, you know, I've got lots of fond memories from that period of time. It was very, very entertaining, very strange, very wild, but it's certainly akin to this friend stage of development, you know, looking for, well, what are we looking for? And that's the question.
Do you think that there is, that JP coming along might have brought people who otherwise wouldn't have been interested in going down a path like this? Or was he just simply the one magnet that all the people who were already intended to go down this path latched onto?
Ooh,
you know, like a question
that's
of
a good question.
Yeah. Of like, is it, are some, and this was something I wanted to ask you a little bit later, like the question of nature versus nurture. Like, how much is destiny actually pre-written? Because me bringing up the point that in my immediate circle, no one really gives a fuck about Jung or Nietzsche or anything like this, you know, and like, they don't want to hear me tell them not to watch porn and stuff like that. But but what I'm thinking is that are some people just like inherently interested, naturally interested in these sort of realms, and they just happen to magnetize onto JP? Or did JP bring out of people who might not have otherwise have been interested? You know, and,
yeah,
and if people are naturally, that explains why the boyos are so close as well, because they're all naturally, they're going to be going there. They have, you know.
Yeah. I think it's mostly that way around. I think people have a natural tendency. Of course, this is what we talk about on Jung to Live By, is the idea of the personal myth. When you know, Jung has this idea of the self. Of course, the self is one of the main things in Ion. But what Steve and Pauline suggested, this is part of their model, which is what Carl Jung's son, Franz Jung, blessed within them and said, carry on the promise to bring my father's work into the reach of ordinary people. So the model there has Franz Jung's seal of approval, which is incredibly humbling.
Are really, other really people cool out there practicing without the seal of approval?
Well, if you want to look at the field of Jungians, it's like, well, Jungian psychology or Jungian analysis is a field, it is a job title. And so you can go and get accredited. The thing with Steve and Pauline is they went to Carl Jung's house in May 1992, to speak with and became family friends with Carl Jung's son.
Nice.
So Carl Jung's son said, I'm really pleased with what you guys are doing. And, you know, they remained close family friends, and Steve and Pauline made a promise to Franz, said, we will bring your father's work into the reach of ordinary people. And that's what they've been doing. They were doing it even before then. And that's what they've been doing. But part of the model is, well, mind and body are two sides of the same coin. It's not psychoreductive. It's not bioreductive. Whereas Ion, for example, as a text taken as such from when it was written, is psychoreductive by nature. There's no mention of biology. It's like, here's all these different ideas. What Steve and Pauline have said is, forget the self. What about the genomic self? That makes more sense.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, it grounds it, which means that your genome, or the gradual release of yourself over your lifespan development from the genome, is the equivalent of the self. And so therefore you have a teleology that's built into you. You're born and you die. That's the obvious teleology that anyone could ever have. But what about you getting yourself a wife? What about, you know, expecting a father, expecting a mother, expecting to have psychosocial relationships? That's the purpose of the anima and the animus. They're all built into you. And it does seem that people have innate
and they're linked physiologically somehow.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
So when if Jordan Peterson comes along and he gets people interested or initiated in a path, I think so. I think that some people have that natural interest, especially we talk about in more typological terms, colloquially, of course, intuitive thinking types, probably most of the time, you know, ENTPs, INTPs, INTJs, ENTJs, that kind of crowd. But obviously Peterson brings a lot of other things with it. But you've got to remember as well that like the Academy doesn't really want to talk about either Jung or Nietzsche, to be absolutely fair, or lots of the things Peterson talks about. He comes
just
from an academic.
Too woo-woo, or is there a political aspect to it?
I think both in a way. The depth psychologists in many ways did it to themselves, which is really sad. Right. You know, the current, if you're going to go see an analyst, the current norm is CBT or counseling or cognitive-based therapy. Mm-hmm. Now, this appears to be because Peterson's a clinical psychologist.
Yeah.
But that's the type of psychology that he practices. However, he's created a philosophy. So he's simultaneously a psychologist and a philosopher. So then Peterson becomes, he's an interesting position then, because you attract people who would be legitimate clinicians, for example, myself. And then you would attract people who simply want to actualize, and this is what they believe is the best way to do it. And then you also attract people who are interested in psychedelics and everything else around that. And it's like, well, okay, he's initiated a lot of different people. But I think when people get, you know, they're under Peterson's wing, if you like, I think lots of people are still there.
Yeah.
And that's a little bit of a concern to myself. It's like, you've not fully actualized yet, despite standing up straight with your shoulders back. And
sure.
All the other things that are in those books.
And you must imagine there's a bit of a regression too. All the people that did, you know, stand up straight with their shoulders back and clean their rooms. Like Peterson's absence over the last year, I'm sure might have, like people might have forgotten about him. It could have just been like that flash in the pan where they got really interested in it, but they never took it to the next step, where maybe they found the Uber Boyo channel, or they found yourself, or they just found, maybe they went to the original texts, you know, like they never just took it to another level.
Yes. Yeah. I think that's absolutely right. Yeah. And you know, at the current moment, and has been for about the last year or so since starting Jung to Live By, my concern, at least with ideas, is their practicality. And so, for example, what you found with Peterson is, this is interesting. You can let me know what you think about this, actually.
Okay.
So the words that Peterson speaks to somebody, and we're all inspired by them, why are they effective? Is it because of the position he's in psychodynamically with yourself? So, for example...
Or as like the father, the next...
Yeah. Okay. Is it because of that, or is it because the ideas hold value?
Uh-huh.
Now, it doesn't have to be one or the other, but it does make you think. Because could Peterson sneak, not saying that he does, I'm not saying he's a malintentioned man whatsoever. Yeah. Could he, as a thought experiment, sneak in an idea, like maybe an old school hypnotherapist like Milton Erickson might do, sneak in an idea and people go, yeah, that's really good. You know,
for the Scrooge McDuck motive to just sell you a bunch of books.
It could be, or for the lulls or whatever. It does make you think, it does make you feel. It's like,
yeah, you know what, James, like it's totally plausible, and it fucking makes sense too, because if you just reduce what Peterson does say, I mean, they're extraordinarily simple arguments, which are actually inherently known. Everyone knows these things. But nonetheless, you'll hang on to every word he says. But yeah, I mean, yeah, no, there's a lot I want to say about that, but I do want to actually, continue on from the very first thing that I said to you.
Okay, sure.
Okay. Because now you discuss, Peterson was the catalyst for you that led you down the route that you're currently pursuing fully.
Yeah.
Before that though, I'm thinking about what makes you different as a person. Like, is it just obviously, you know, smart guy, PhD, molecular biologist, depth psychologist, and all this. Mm. But before that, was there a separating path that you went down? I know you speak about anecdotally 18 when your former best mate, I hope, took your ex-girlfriend. When I heard you say that, I was thinking, was that this moment where James could break away from whatever the mundanity that might have consumed the next few years of his life with these group of lads? And then he got a chance to just like, now I got to figure myself out. I can't lean on other people around me when I'm insecure anymore, because, you know, and obviously you never talk about it, but like just lean on them generally, to go out with them and to hang out with them and to play FIFA and loads of stuff. I mean, I think about these years, I'm only 2 or 3 years older than you, but I mean, I quite objectively just wasted like 4 or 5 years doing absolutely nothing, not even, you know, and I'm just thinking, what is it? What happened to you? Was there a fork in the road, or is this just like is it a non-issue? Is it something that you haven't thought about or
No, that's absolutely right. So I've gone into my own personal myth quite a lot over the last year, and I knew this was a key moment for me anyway, but it's clear even going through it, it's like this was key. I was very, very different before and after.
Okay.
And what it did, I think, is it snapped me out of a lot of nonsense that was going on in my head. And it made me aware, it didn't solve, but it made me aware of a lot of maladaptations. So you can imagine if you're dating a girl who's pretty attractive and, you know, you've been doing it for 2 years and it's like, well, this thing's, you know, again, if you look at psychodynamics, I was the shyest kid in school right up until I was 16. The shyest. Okay. Might be a little bit difficult to be like, well, that doesn't make any sense. Every single parent's evening, they'd be like, why don't you put your hands up? Everyone would be like, well, why don't you talk to me? And all this kind of stuff. But as soon as I got this girlfriend of mine, she, you know, I'd fancied her, and since I was about 11 or 12 years old, and we'd wave to each other across the playground. It was like an Arthurian romance.
Yeah.
And she was like an Arthurian princess.
Okay.
Really, truly she was, and is, obviously I presume she's not dead, but as soon as, you know, we got together and we were 16, my shyness disappeared. I didn't notice that at the time. But my status, if you like, was raised, because that's what
confirms a man. Well, you became socially validated.
Yeah.
Dynamic.
Yeah. 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 And it's like we weren't even like competing in like the normal arena. It's like we formed our own little clique.
Uh-huh.
And it was that little clique that I broke away from when the breakup happened. So I go down, you know, it's a long breakup for my best friend at the time. And I enter into a horrible deep depression for about 6 months afterwards. But during this deep depression, it's not like I'm sitting there crying to myself. I get very, very angry, and I get suddenly very, very interested in what it means to be a man. That's what came out of it, is what is a man? So it was this idea of status, and articulated a thought came to mind that I wanted to explore to explain what neurological changes had happened. And that's really what kicked a lot of this off, because that's when I stopped being the science nerd. Because I wasn't really one of the lads to do FIFA and pints with at this particular time. I did a little bit later, of course. But at that point, it was science was everything, and Richard Dawkins and Neil deGrasse Tyson, and I love all these things, and you know, Hank Green and everything else on YouTube. And I was like, screw all of that. I don't care anymore.
Yeah,
I really don't care. I like molecular biology. That's interesting, but also I'm a human being, and I have feelings and experiences. And I just got hurt. And that's more real than anything I've ever learned in school. I want to find out what that's all about. And that's what kicked me off on this path. So there was always a split there from university onwards, was the academia that I was meant to love and enjoy from when I was very small. I'm going to be a professor. And then actually, I'm going to start reading every self-improvement book that ever came out. I want to find out what it is to be a man. I'm going to watch characters like Elliot Hulse and, for example, Universal Man on YouTube. There was that split. And then Peterson comes along, and he's like a watershed moment for myself, along with the election personally of Donald Trump and Brexit in the UK. There's whole stories associated with those that go, I get more and more and more invested in that side of things. And then it snaps.
And you start to see a lot differently. Yeah.
Yeah.
In that 6 month initial depression, were there any big creative works that came out? I'm just thinking like, you know, like maybe just personal journals you wrote. Obviously the ideas were flowing, but like, was there something that you could, you know, tangibly go back to and be like, this is what I created in that time period?
I wouldn't say outside of myself. I'd say inside of myself. It was like, internal alchemy started flowing. I didn't start journaling properly until a few years after that. But no, I wasn't concerned with creativity at that point in time either. Cause being the archetypal, if you like, scientist up to that point, I thought creativity and the arts and literature was all nonsense.
Yeah, right. It's for the hippies.
Utter nonsense. Exactly. Yeah. So, but I remember I absolutely consumed myself in music, And I consumed myself with like two friends at the time. I think the only two that I wanted to keep talking to.
One at a bar.
And, and then, you know, I remember taking long, I'd never gone to, so where we live back at home with my parents, there's this huge forest that's just next to the house. And I'd never really taken interest in going there. I was like, you know what? I'm going to load up all these self-development podcasts and stuff on my phone or whatever it was at the time. Mm. I'm just going to go walk and see what I can find. Mm. I just walk to the end of the forest. You know, my mum at the time would be like, oh, don't be back in time for tea. I'm like, no. It's the first time as well. I'd be like, no. Right. I'll just go do my own thing. So I just have fond memories of finding myself, but in an emotional alchemical sense, I think. Mm-hmm. In your gut, when you know changes are going on, you can feel it if you're focused. It's like things are changing and churning. Yeah.
Yeah. I just had the thought, because you are a microbiologist, right? With your depth psychology, are you focusing on the physiology as well? Like, I'm not too sure what I'm trying to ask you, actually. I'm wondering about the connection between physiologically how you feel and emotionally how you feel. And obviously, it's a massive connection.
But no, it is. It's a really, really fascinating area of inquiry, because it's not obvious at the moment, because there seems to be this idea of mind and body being separate a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. Some of that's for religious reasons, and you know, some of that's culturally, because Descartes comes along and he goes, oh, mind and body are separate.
Why, like, religious reasons?
Well, you know, soul and body, for example. Oh, so it's okay. Like we are a soul within a biological vector. Regardless of personal beliefs, the evidence is crystal clear. The mind and the body are linked. They're two sides of the same coin. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, one of the coolest examples of it is what the early hypnotists found, which nowadays we call like a dissociative disorder or dissociative phenomenon.
Yeah.
But they called it hysteria back in the day. You can look at Freud and Breuer's text from the 1890s on this, studies on hysteria. It's like the founding text of psychotherapy, if you like. Cool. And they would notice that people would come in with like paralyzed limbs and weird headaches and contractions in their bodies. And they're like, but it's linked to psychology.
Mm.
What? How can you have like a paralyzed limb from your psychology? It's like the area of psychosomatics. And it's like, through hypnosis, you can move these symptoms around the body, first of all, or remove them. And that's very
strange. It's so insane.
It's very strange. But this has now been updated. Take a look at the works of Ernest Rossi. Ernest Rossi, absolutely fantastic, fantastic work. And he forms an essential part of the curriculum for IPSA students. He has shown that hypnosis can influence gene expression.
Okay.
Which is like, that's...
Which means like you can be hypnotized to change like a way a gene manifests. Like, I can change, I don't know, maybe my eye color or something.
Well, yes. So if I scream at you really loudly in your ear, then you're going to get stressed, especially if I do it for a laugh when you're not looking. So it's like, well, a psychological thing, if you're like, or a word from outside of yourself has hit your psychology and it goes down into your body. Or if you're watching a horror film or something like that, your psychology is invested in it, because your psychology is that which mediates between the biology and the horror film in that moment, right? It's that sort of like transistor through which the energy passes. So things go into your psychology, down into your biology, and the stress response comes from adrenaline and cortisol, and that's gene expression on certain genes, would you say, turning on and others turning off. So we know that me talking and you talking changes gene expression, but Ernest Rossi has found, among many, many, many other things, he's one of the true inheritors to the grandmasters, Freud and Jung and et cetera. Hypnosis can influence gene expression. And in the field of psychosomatics, he's linked this to ultradian rhythms and sleep and things like that. So with the Charing Cross method, it is mostly, or in terms of practicality, it's physiological, but the theory is still psychobiological. Mm-hmm. It's like, well, if you fix the chassis, things get better. Because everyone knows this, if you're sleep deprived, any symptom you have, usually speaking, gets worse. So they are two sides of the same coin. Mm-hmm. And to ignore one in favor of the other is very, very silly.
And I suppose this line of academia, or this just idea, isn't necessarily accepted or studied and pursued in the mainstream. I imagine like there's huge potential for this if, you know, all of a sudden, rather than, 100 people working at it, the accumulated benefit of maybe 10,000 people working at it, like you can make leaps and bounds in discoveries.
It is. Yeah. Yeah. It's, I wouldn't say that it's rejected per se by the academy, but it certainly needs way more attention than it's getting.
The academy. What does that refer to? I always see people refer to the academy. What is the academy actually?
Well, the academy broadly speaking is like the universities and the institutions that by virtue of them having lots of people and lots of funding are the norm or the zeitgeist within whenever everyone's studying. So yeah, I mean, as I said earlier, if you have like some kind of what you believe to be psychological issue that you want fixed, you go find a therapist, at least in the UK, frontline, you're going to meet a CBT therapist. Mm-hmm. And the CBT therapist will essentially go, how are you feeling? And then you go, okay, I'm feeling X, Y, Z. And they go, well, you know what? You can change the way you feel through your thinking. And that's as far as it goes. And I suppose you could say that that's, you know, thoughts transducing into the body, especially if it's like anxiety. Yeah, I guess so. But that's as shallow as it goes. Mm-hmm. And it's such a shame. One, because there's so much richness out there in what people can, in what we do understand. And by we, it's like the royal we do understand this. But people are suffering so badly. And a CBT approach does not work for the vast majority of people to truly alleviate symptoms over a long period of time.
Yeah.
Doesn't work.
Is CBT essentially just depth psychology? Is just not deep enough? Like, because you are inquiring into like, well, what's the source of this problem? And we'll go back a little bit and we'll go back a little bit and try and figure out, oh, you know, my father didn't give me enough attention. And then it's like, okay, you know, maybe that's the weight off your back that you needed to solve this crippling anxiety you had in, I don't know, public forums, whatever. With depth, can you explain how it differs from, regular psychology, if that's a good question?
Okay, so take the exact example that you gave that might have its roots in, say, the father never gave me the love or something that I wanted or I needed is actually the key point there, I think.
Okay.
Then, you know, a CBT therapist would go, okay, we found the problem here. Or they won't even necessarily find the problem. They'll just say you present with anxiety and then you can reframe the anxiety with your thoughts, which doesn't work at all. It's nonsense.
Is that they just Band-Aid on a broken bone sort of stuff?
Pretty much. Yeah. It's like, you know, it's a bit of a meme with CBT, but you get like diagrams that they draw in the sessions and go, well, have you thought, you can think about it like this. You can take your thought and put it in a box, your intrusive thought, put it in a box. And it's like, go away. No, absolutely not. No.
But
a depth psychologist would go, okay, what are you presenting with? You go, okay, I'm presenting with anxiety. Then what you do is you get a full case history from the person. You try and learn as much about the person as you possibly can, about the person's personal myth. Then using the theory and what naturally comes up in the moment, and this is just standard psychotherapy rather than, say, hypnotherapy or something more specialized, you would pinpoint where the source of the anxiety came from. And then you address the psychobiological need or the psychobiological occurrence or phenomenon that happened within that person. So for example, if it happened to be that the father not just didn't give you the love that you needed, but you had an overprotective mom at the same time that held you back and your dad did not pull you forward and confirm you as a man, then you're not just presenting with anxiety. You're probably, maybe, this is just a random example, you're presenting with the fact you can't talk to women. You can't really talk to other men. You're incredibly nervous all the time. You're not living out your potential. Maybe you're still living with your mother. And your father is not there to protect you. It's like, okay, that's now complicated because you as a human being in a body with also a mind has certain expectations. This is all the archetypes are as well, by the way. A lot of them are culturally generated fantasies that have resonance with an underlying psychobiological instinct substructure. Yeah. So would you take the mother and the father? If those things are not fulfilled, you're going to generate problems. So it's then a delicate dialectic between the patient and the therapist, perhaps combining with other techniques as well, like hypnotherapy, to try and get that person back to where they should have been at their current age. So if someone's 20 years old, you want to return them to where a healthy 20-year-old should be, which is confirmed as a man, got a group of friends, preferably, and is there knowing what he wants, knowing where the anima is going. This is because it's currently going all over the place. That's very, very different to going, you have anxiety, think about it differently.
Yeah. In that specific case, where you identify that this person had the overprotecting mother and that father didn't give enough attention, through just conversation hypnotherapy, I'm wondering how does a person overcome so much experience of acting and thinking a certain way. Like, this is the thing that just blows my mind about psychology in general. How do people make such radical changes? I mean, it's obviously a contextual question, right? And I'm sure everybody's different, but curious thought about that.
Mm. Well, the psychodynamic model that we use at IPSA, we discussed it on the channel, but I guess sort of synthesize it. We look at Professor George Engel's biopsychosocial model. So you've got a biological layer, a psychological layer, and a social layer. And there are layers up and above and layers out, down, and beneath that, all the way down to the quantum you, and all the way up to, I guess, potentially the galactic things. Basically, you're many different things we can discreetly break into layers that are influencing an individual at any one time.
Mm.
You know? So the psychodynamic model that we then put in the psychological layer is like, well, you have this is very, very, very sort of simplified version, but I think it helps to illustrate it. You've got the ego or the ego. You've got complexes. This is what we work with clinically. You've got complexes in the unconscious, you generally speaking. They can be ego aligned or ego identified. There's things with that. But basically, you've got complexes. Underneath that, you've got the anima and the animus. But the anima and the animus are essentially a cluster of instincts or the seven basic emotional systems that come together and form its own circuit that then goes out and seeks. And for a man, it's primed genetically to imprint onto a woman and vice versa, a woman onto a man. So it's like, well, how can people make rapid changes? Well, if you look at the complex layer, complexes are the stuff of therapy. It's like things are going wrong. It's like, okay, you identify where they are. And yes, they do. They tell you what you are, even though they're lying to you, or they adapt you to certain things, or they fill your head with certain ideas, or they generate symptoms in your body, loads of stuff. They redirect your libido, but the instincts are underneath, and the instincts are so much more powerful. If you can get someone in touch with their instincts, the complexes, if they're pathological and that's what you're there to remove, it blows them out of the water completely. And it is rapid, rapid, rapid changes. The usual trajectory with someone doing real individuation in this sense is very, very, you know, you start it off and then you go vroom, up like that, and then you slowly plateau off. But it's that vroom, that's like the instincts are starting to power through. So it is it's returning you to where you should have been all along at this stage in your life.
I really love that, James, that example of how the complex exists here, but the instinct exists here. And if you can get through the complex to hit the instinct, it's going to destroy the complex. And that's actually really interesting. I've never been spoken to a psychologist before, but, you know, I've had like, you know, very down moments, but I feel like you like almost by just a lot of self-reflection, self-rationalization, maybe just leaning on what other people are saying that you might find online. Like when you said that, it actually resonated with me so much, because it's like, yeah, as soon as you find that instinct, all of a sudden this complex that you had, it barely registers anymore. You can actually just throw it away at will, you know?
Really interesting. You can. I mean, just because we've discussed it briefly, myself, say before and after getting that first girlfriend, and I said I was the shyest kid in school. And then afterwards, I was not. I was able to be confident in myself. And it was an immediate change. So, okay, James before then, so let's say 14-year-old James would have said, I'm an introvert, because I learned what the word introvert is in school. And therefore, I don't like talking to people.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we call an ego fiction. That is a complex. Now, what the etiology of the complex is, that's further investigation. But it's a lie. It's a complete lie. Everyone wants to talk to other people. Everybody wants to be confident. And they know in their DNA that they will, or they should have been confident. Mm-hmm. It's like, what was missing? Well, it was confirmation of some kind that was then granted in the form of that girl. It's like, wow, suddenly the instinct, that masculine instinct, that confidence that comes along with it, and that's a broad category of many different instincts, vroom, shot up, blew that complex out of the water, gone, finished. And it was an instant overnight thing.
Yeah. Oh, that's really cool. And I suppose if you extrapolate this out to like severe cases where someone might have a complex that's straight up crippling their life, the potential is still there to, well, if you can find the instinct. And maybe that's what JBP just resonates so much, because he speaks to your instinct. He speaks past the complex, you know?
Yes. And I think the instinct that he speaks to, which I think is evident in the, you know, the people who like him, or the demographic and the people who like him, is he's acting as that potential confirmatory figure, which, you know, a lot of the guys, a lot of the boyos, or a lot of the Jordan Peterson fans, and I think Peterson's been clear on this as well, they call him like the father of the internet. It's like, well, maybe their fathers weren't as, for whatever reason, and it's partly cultural, it's partly personal, it's partly ancestral. Yeah. They not give you the confirmation you needed, and then Peterson is doing it. I mean, and then Peterson's also got loads of other things with it, but I think, you know, as we were saying earlier, that's why people are there.
This is tangential and pure speculation as well. Do you think, so if I look at my father's generation, his father's generation, and so forth, the men didn't have access to these thoughts and education at the same scale that they have now. And I'm thinking, is our generation going to be much better fathers because of someone like JBP who came through? Because we, in our late teens, early 20s, and early 30s, whatever, have had to introspect, think about our relationships with our fathers, identify things that you didn't like, and maybe go through and do it differently. Because this just didn't happen before, you know? Could there be all of this new generation of fathers who are going to come through, and they'll do all the wrong things as well, but they'll at least have like the self-introspection, and they'll be able to realize early when they were thinking about things like this to then perhaps be better fathers, and maybe, you know, then raise better children who will then be better parents themselves? Like, I don't know what you make of that. It's a bit of a rambling statement, not really a question. But do you take anything away from that?
Yeah, I think you've nailed the theory of the instinct that's being enticed, not activated, but enticed and drawn to the figure of Jordan Peterson. It is that idea of, okay, can I address the wound that potentially I had with not even necessarily my own father? It's like the father imago as such. That's more of a Jungian term, but it is that a man needing to feel like he has his purpose, he's confident, he's on the right path, he's confirmed as a man. Now, whether or not Peterson leads to that, well, we have no idea. I don't even know if we've got any data to even begin to extrapolate and say, well, Peterson was a force for good for the next generation. Because then you're influenced, you know. And one of the reasons why I say that is if you're doing true depth work, real true depth work, this individuation or adaptation to your lifespan, the interest or in technical terms, attachment to Peterson should die off because suddenly you don't have the father anymore. However, that's a terrible business model. So for example, I've never seen, and this is again, not a malintention on his part whatsoever. He knows, and I believe he said that, you know, he's like a dad to people. He's never once ever addressed the transference, because that's what you're seeing then, is a transference that you hold him every word, never addressed it. So, you know, if you want to,
it's pretty malicious if it's intentional.
And again, I don't have enough data to even begin to say that. I would hope not. I think not, you know, but this is what happens with lots of gurus that people latch onto, is it's like a father transference a large chunk of the time. And then the guru, one doesn't have the information usually, but doesn't care. You know, and it's like, I will keep you trapped. Here's one more course, here's one more product, here's one more this, here's one more this.
I noticed actually several times on Facebook over the last few weeks, the self-authoring program is now like they're paying for Facebook ads, you know? And I'd never seen Facebook ads on that before. And I suppose it's going to correlate with Jordan's return into the public sphere. It will be.
You know, he's made inevitable. A tremendous amount of money out of this. He said he'd made something like, I think it was $8 million or something in 2018 or 2017. So, you know, he's in many ways he's benefited a lot, but also he's suffered a huge amount as well. I've got many, many, many things I could say on these topics, but perhaps I'll pass it back to yourself if you want to reorient or.
I will reorient. I hinted earlier, I want to understand the anima better. So I have a lovely girlfriend. She's just in the other room. We've been dating for several years. We live together in Stockholm, and it's clear to everyone and ourselves, like, you know, we get along, we love each other very much. If you could give me like a crash course in the anima, and so how I can think about it, in my relationship with my girlfriend? You know, I know that's probably an unfair question to ask, but
no, I find it actually quite amusing that you've asked, because one of the first videos we did on the Young to Live By channel about 8 months ago now, I said the exact same thing to Steve at the start. I was like, Steve, in a few lines, what is the anima? And Steve goes, well, James, it's complicated as hell.
And why do I love Jane? Yeah, exactly.
So getting into the idea of, in fact, this includes the shadow as well, getting into what you would traditionally call the archetypes, and I know that they're listed in IOM in particular, just for context, because you mentioned it earlier, as being archetypes. It's there's a huge, enormous amount of misinformation out there. And a lot of this is actually the fault of Carl Jung, the man, because his early work was fantastic. He said things like, which is definitely true, archetypes are the self-portrait of instincts, which they are. But then they seem to have gone off in his later work. And, there's a lot about the personal myth of Carl Jung that we can touch on and all that stuff. Uh-huh. But he did go down a strange archetypal fantasy route. And that's where Ion came from. Ion is Carl Jung's personal myth, which is fascinating to consider. Yeah. So, if you look up the anima normally, what you'll find is it is an inner woman and it is the inner feminine of a man. It's wrong. Mm-hmm. And I tell you immediately why that's wrong, because we now have genetic information.
Because that's generally how it's understood. Sense,
it is. But it cannot be the feminine or the female part of a man, because it's male psychology. What Jung hypothesized is the reason why we have an anima as a man is because you have a minority number of female genes. And so that's what you're getting in touch with, or in broad terms. It's not, it's male psychology. So an anima projection or an anima possession is masculine psychology. That reframes it hugely, and takes all the woo-woo power out of it, because it's like, okay, you've got this important system that it's one of the stuff, it's one of the main things you'd work with in therapy, for example, at IPSA, that, is key to a man's life. But it's like, well, what is it? It's the relating function. So, what does that mean? It's that part of psychobiology that mediates relating between yourself and yourself, so the inner world, where you're meant to be, who you are, and simultaneously, like as above, so below, inner reflects outer, you're relating between yourself and the outside world, other people. So if you go back to that, where I mentioned briefly, the biopsychosocial model, it's like, the anima is operant at any layer at any one time. Because it normally manifests psychosocially. For example, as we're speaking, the anima is involved in that, because we are relating to one another in some capacity. But it's at every single layer, there is a mediation of relation between those different layers. So if you ground down what a man wants and what a man needs, and use this idea of libido and attention and energy, then you start to build up a picture of a man and his anima. A man, we talk about in Jungian psychology, a man might want to wed his anima. And it's like, well, that's a complicated thing. But if you imagine it takes on the form, generally speaking, of a woman, it's like, okay, I want to wed you. What the hell does this mean? Just like you'd want to wed an external woman, perhaps. The idea is, and you can use this principle for yourself, my friend, in every moment. This is a really good depth psychology exercise.
Okay.
It's a phrase that I believe Steve came up with. By his libido, by her libido, ye shall know them. So what that means is, in every waking moment, your attention is drawn to something. That's your anima doing it. And it's a riddle. Can you solve it? If you solve the riddle, you've wedded the anima. Done.
It's almost your missing piece that is in the female that you are most attracted to, but not just physically attracted, but just attracted to. Whereas what you just said, it doesn't really include that, I suppose.
It does. So what I explicated there would be the anima in the broadest possible terms. But but you're absolutely right. So for example, you'd be walking down the street and suddenly a girl turns up and you feel it in your body as well. There's something that captures you about it.
Yeah.
And that's far less even Jung than it is Plato. Okay. Plato's theory of forms. It's like, well, there's a woman there and she appears in her physical appearance and perhaps in the way that she acts to be quite a strong or stronger than the average woman distillation of this divine form of the feminine, which is, you've got divine as a general imago. You would have like a man and you'd have a woman, the archetype man, archetype woman. man's perspective, he's drawn to that archetypal feminine. But what happens is individual women are distillations of it. All the ancestral women who've ever lived, you know?
Okay.
And so what you will do is you will project onto that. So yes, it is the missing piece of your soul, but this is the sneaky thing. It's a projection, which means it's coming from you.
From you,
seeing partly yourself. So in many ways, it is technically narcissistic, which is fascinating. There's nothing wrong with it. It's fascinating. It's like, in many ways, you're falling in love with yourself, because yes, you do anticipate to complete your genome. I mean that colloquially. Complete your genome in terms of, she has what I need.
Yeah, interesting.
And of course, and then you link it straight down into Darwin and biology, and it's like, well, yeah, the anima therefore is one of the strongest things that will drive it, is that completion of the genome. It is to mate and to relate. It's complicated.
Yeah, certainly. And I'm just thinking, apply it to myself. You know, I look at Emma and I'm like, okay. You know, I can obviously understand why we have such a good relationship. And there are freaky synchronicities that occur between the two of us. I've always thought of the anima as like your anima, their anima, and they attract. But rather, it sounds like it's your anima and you're projecting your own anima, you know, like in this narcissistic way, like you're projecting something of yourself that you want. Perhaps you don't even realize how badly you want it, but as that projection onto this particular person. So then the question, I guess, becomes like, why this person and not this person? Is there something else happening here that isn't purely evolutionary, where it's like, well, she looks like she can make good babies versus this one, you know? Like,
there is.
What is that then?
Well, a man can never experience the anima as such. It's too big a psychobiological construct. It's enormous. It's going to be over 50% of a man's psychology. But you interact with the anima through an anima complex. So it mediates information flow between them psychobiologically. So the anima complex has an anima type. So that's why different men, for example, might have a different type of woman. And that's both in physical appearance, but way less than that, it's both in character. So this will be shaped by so many things, including your mom, your dad, your culture, everything will come together, including your own genomic potential as well. Because your genome or the genomic self, and again, these are more colloquial terms when we're discussing it like this, it will know its own potential.
That's such a cool idea.
Yeah.
Like, you somehow inherently know that your genes are going to work really well with those genes, you know?
Yes.
That's what you're saying, right?
Yeah. I mean, you think about the idea of pheromones is one of them, of course, and two people can be compatible. True. And it's like, one of the reasons why people kiss, and this is verified research, but I heard about this about 5 years ago, so it might be outdated now, but I hope not, because it's cool. You know, when you say to a girl, like, we have good chemistry, bit of a weird term. Bit weird. What happens when you kiss, or you're mixing your biochemistry together, and you can kiss one girl and be like, oh my God, that was an amazing kiss. And you can kiss another girl and be like, oh, we've got no chemistry. And it's because you're swapping antigens and immune really profiles so that they can be optimal for, say, a child going forward. But you've not just got two of exactly the same. You've got things that are varied, so the child's got the best possible immune profile, which is cool and interesting.
Super cool. It's just it leads me back to what I was thinking earlier, like when I gave the anecdote of my mom, like, we just don't know. We don't know about the body, you know? Like, we can understand a little bit, but we don't know for sure. I wonder if you've heard this anecdotally before, and maybe, do you know who Nassim Taleb is?
I do. Yeah.
So he writes in one of his books, he talks about the differences in complexities, because this guy's a mathematician. And in the brain of a ringworm, maybe there's 100 neurons. And he says, we don't understand how that brain works, right? But then in the brain of a human, there's billions of neurons. And the complexity is such that going from a billion to a billion and one doubles the complexity, right? Mm-hmm. So it's just infinitely complex. And even though we can map a genome, and like we can map the human biology, we don't actually understand how it really works together
as a system. No, we don't.
Yeah. And I'm just thinking, like, this is sort of all coming to me as you're talking now about, you know, me being able to project not just superficially like good genome potential, but somehow inherently, like, you know.
Well, yeah, it makes mathematical sense. I mean, to use projecting and that kind of thing. So women, okay, what do women find attractive in a man? And it's like, there are lots of people who try to break this down. Mm-hmm. We can just say broadly, and I think this simplifies everything, women find potential attractive in a man. If they're older, you know, it's kind of like, well, you've hopefully would have actualized your potential, or at least some of it by now. But when you're young, you don't have, say, a 16-year-old girl who wants to get with the top of the hierarchy man. That's bollocks. Yeah. They're not going to go for the 36-year-old man. They're going to go for the guy who's around them in their own hierarchy, or in the school across the street or something like that, who has the potential to release. So this whole idea of it's just status hierarchies.
That's such a good way to draw it back.
The old couple that's there holding hands on the seaside, and it's like, okay, why doesn't this old woman go with the young stud or something who can provide better for maybe her kids? It's like, no, they've fallen in love and we leave it there. It's done. They've completed their genome. And again, I have to keep saying that'll be a colloquial phrase, but it makes sense. It's what it means. But I mean, to make the anime, I think, practical. So I think this could clear up a lot of stuff. It's like, okay, let's take yourself as an example then. Your libido, your life force, as a general term, is flowing towards making podcasts like this, I think would be fair to say. Some of it, a whatever percentage. And it's also flowing towards Emma, you were saying.
Yeah.
It's also flowing towards Taleb and maybe, you know, other forms of learning like that. And that's all I really know about yourself. But immediately now you've got an anima that's going here. And it's like, why? That's the question. Yeah. So in a relationship.
I'm trying to fulfill this potential. And I see these as vectors for the potential.
Yes. So, and this is what dreams do as well, by the way. The body wants to individuate, or your psychobiology wants to individuate, wants to release its potential. And its potential is like adaptation to lifespan development. So when you're four, releasing your potential is being attached to the mother in a way. Four is probably too late for that. But you know what I mean? It's like when you're very small, it's the mother. And then you get a bit old, it'll be your dad. And then as soon as you enter puberty, or even long before then, suddenly your lifespan potential, or the stage where you're at, your genome changes, gene expression changes. And it's like, I want a girl now. It's like, okay, there's lots of bits and pieces then up in the air as to where your attention and your energy in any moment could go. If you solve the riddle to be like, what am I attracted to this for? By his libido, ye shall know him. Then you can gain consciousness, and then you can consciously decide to individuate. Now, most people don't do this because there's no need to. It's an unconscious process that manifests. When you suffer for some reason, that's then you go, okay, something's wrong. Because this is, again, going back to the work of Ernest Rossi, a lot of symptoms can be signals from the unconscious to say something is wrong.
What you just said about naturally individuating versus something goes wrong and then you intentionally individuate, it reminds me of what Jung said exactly. People will naturally individuate. However, just like if you want to improve your physical body, you will go to the gym and you will work at it. The individuation is the Holy Grail myth. Like you'll never reach it, but you'll at least go so much further by working at it than if you just let it naturally happen. And also the idea that it is the Holy Grail myth. I love that as like a universal theme as well, or for life. There isn't ever an end goal. It's just about working towards something.
Yes.
And it doesn't even matter if you get there or not. It's literally just about working towards things.
So now we can reframe people who might be interested in Young to Live By, or might be interested in Jordan Peterson, or in Taleb, or whatever. It's like the average thing you ask somebody, and they've not really thought about it because it's unconscious. You say, why are you interested in this? It's like, well, it's cool. It's fascinating. I'm a psychonaut. It's like, no, wrong. That's just wrong. Your libido will not care about what's cool. It just won't. It's there beating your heart. It's breathing your lungs. It's like, it's not going to be like, that's cool. Investigate that. Mm-hmm. There will be reasons behind everything. And a lot of it, especially in these more intellectual spheres, is going to be autobiographical, your interest in it, and it's going to be an attempt at self-cure, even though there's nothing wrong per se, you're not experiencing anything. Mm-hmm. It's going to be that attempt to return yourself to a homeostasis as to where you might happen to be at this moment in time. So, and that's all individuation is. It removes all the woo-woo. Is it's just releasing your potential, and it's psychobiological, and it depends on the stage in life in which you're at. It is not integrating the anima and meeting the self and transcending out of your body into la la land, like lots of people think it is. It's not. Alexander the Great was a strongly individuated man, but you might go, well, he killed. He's you know, it's like, no, mate. He achieved it.
Yeah,
he built an empire. He got the women, everything. He did it, and he left a legacy that no man could even hope. And this is what he said as well: that no man could ever hope to reach. Even Julius Caesar wept. Yeah, even Julius Caesar wept before his grave.
Amazing. It's like, okay,
that's a man, and everyone feels that that's a man. It's like, well, that's what we're all aiming towards. Mm. So it's like, in which case, why are we reading these books? Mm-hmm. It's an attempt to try and do something.
Yeah.
But the instincts are leading there.
Oh man, James, now you've really got the neurons going. I'm thinking all these sort of social applications for what you're saying. Mm. But I do hesitate to go down certain routes. But I wonder the potential of a man, I suppose, very archetypally, is to just dominate land, build things, conquer things. For very good reasons, don't do that now because that's just pure anarchy everywhere. So how should people these days go about fulfilling, I don't know, their masculinity? Like what is it? Does it have to just be intellectual things like this? Is Joe Rogan the new archetype for this? Just a guy who can say fuck you to the man and do whatever he wants and be really rich and conquer a lot of new things and whatever. Is he now the archetype for it? Or does that mean that to fulfill the masculinity, you have to be, I don't know, working independent? Like I'm just spitballing here, but I'm sure that you have thought about this sort of stuff before as well. And it's obviously not a very easy thing to answer, because there's not a right answer necessarily. Again, it's just like, well, what are you about? But
you can cut this out of the podcast if you'd like to, but I think you've potentially just revealed to yourself what you're doing.
Okay.
Which is fascinating, because you've dropped down like Alay said, the neurons were turning. That could be a metaphor. If you've dropped down a layer and it's like, what is a man supposed to do? Which is what I hinted at the beginning of the podcast. It's like, I don't know. Is it like this man, you said? And it's kind of like, well, we also spoke earlier as to how people might have some kind of transference onto Peterson to help act as a psychopomp and confirm them as a man. It's like, well, Joe Rogan is acting as the exact same thing. So you're dealing with, I know on the surface, for example, with the Boyo phenomenon, it's like, oh, we're psychonauts and we're looking at Nietzsche and it's like we're like a playground in many ways. You're getting your buckets and spades and you're going like, look at, we're really smart, because that's what it is. And I was there, so I'll take full responsibility for that side of things.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, but ultimately you're all dealing with the same problem. It's an instinctual problem, and so to approach it top down, like, you know, how can I turn myself into a good man, is not going to work. It should be bottom up. And a man will naturally adapt in homeostasis to his environment, whether or not we're in Paleolithic times where we could, you know, grab land and conquer the women and all this kind of thing.
Okay.
We have civilization now. Civilization came naturally from human beings. It's part of our homeostasis. The anima will mediate that between your relationship with myself, mine with you, yours with your culture, mine with my culture, and then how they interact with one another. It's animus development. Human psychology and human biology want homeostasis. They want a natural healing balance. When something's out of whack, that's when people suffer. And suffering can be, I have no idea what being a man is. It's like, then how do we address that? And it will come from, when it's addressed through any other means, but obviously we use it at IPSA through depth psychology. When it's addressed, the problem disappears. You don't think about it again. It's like, I'm going on my path. You know, you might not be concerned about necessarily, you know, an archetype of Joe Rogan or anyone else. It's just like, no, I'm me and I'm happy and that's cool. And I haven't got any of these other bits and pieces going on in my life, or insecurity, or a draw here. You've solved a riddle that your anima was giving you, or the royal you in this situation, which is, why am I interested in Peterson, for example? You've solved it. It's like, well, because I was trying to become a man, but now I'm a man. The anima goes, okay, more energy for you.
And, you know, like you say, Peterson is perhaps not behaving in the responsible way to instruct that he is not the father. He was just a gateway, right? But perhaps you can flip it around and just say all the people that follow him acknowledge who Peterson is. He is not your father, you know?
Yeah.
And then if you can do that, because that's actually something now you've said it, I remember I started calling BS on him after I'd really just, you know, watched everything that he ever did. And I still really love the guy. Like, he's an amazing person. But I started calling BS on some of the stuff. And it's fun you say that. It's like, well, you get more energy from it because you've moved on from that.
Yes.
And I've actually done the exact same thing, now I'm thinking about it, with Taleb. Because he's, he's a terrible public figure. I don't know if I would enjoy talking to the guy at all, but he's still probably the biggest like mentor in my life. But like being able to say BS to that, it does give you more energy. I suppose it, you know, if you just look on the surface level, it almost... it does fulfill you that you may have come to some like confidence in some understanding that you have in a certain topic. And okay. The big one I want to ask you, I know it's 2:30 and I know you got to leave at 3:00, but just tell me like a hard cutoff.
We'll do.
Perhaps you want to leave at 2:40, 2:45. I don't know. But you'll tell me.
Okay, we'll just keep it rolling. We'll break it an actual breaking point.
Let's do this one. I had one about J.K. Rowling and Harry Potter as well, but it's going to go way too tangential if we do that. So the persona, as you saw, I wrote all these articles on Jung, and the persona was actually my favorite one to write because I was like, wow, that's fucking interesting. You know, I do have multiple personas, and it's not about being fake or anything like that. It's like just a coping mechanism. It's an adaptation. Like, you do have multiple personas. And something Jung said was, one of the biggest dangers of the persona is over-identifying with a persona, because then you forget who you are.
Time.
You lose your personality. And I was like, well, this is a clear as day wide phenomenon that's happening today, because your persona is very rarely actually the guy speaking to you. It's your Twitter and the photos you're sending through. It's your Instagram and the life you're presenting. It's your Snapchat and whatever. Like, these personas in generations younger as well. I have a 19-year-old brother. My girlfriend's sister is in the other room. She's just turned 20. Like, these generations, like, there is a very clear over-identification with these personas. Can you speak about over-identification with the persona? And if you agree with me that the social medias proliferate, it's the over-identification with the persona,
yes,
these social medias.
Yeah, it does. I think that's absolutely spot on. I think that's what causes a lot of the misery with social media. But yeah, the persona is obviously the face that we wear to the world, and it's you can never not have a persona. If you drop it completely, then it's like, you know, you might say that when you get super drunk or something like that, you drop the persona completely. But to understand some of this stuff, I think it's useful to say is that you can say that the persona is the face that the ego or the conscious mind wears to the world. But the anima is like the persona of the unconscious. It's what mediates that information flow. It's that face that it wears, and it's what comes to you oftentimes in dreams, et cetera, et cetera. So they operate in balance. So if you overamp your persona, then you consolidate the negative pole of the anima by necessity. And then you could say, like, for example, when you're drunk, then, you know, you might completely drop the persona. And then your positive anima goes up. You're relating so well and you're so happy. Mm-hmm. But then the next morning, you're like, oh my God, my persona dropped. What did people see? And then the anxiety comes in and stuff like that. That particular example is a bit more complicated psychodynamically. But so, yeah, if you over-identify with your persona, then usually that means you're over-amping your persona, generally speaking, in moment-to-moment terms, then you consolidate the negative pole of the anima, or the animus, if you're a woman. And by necessity, because we defined earlier the anima and the animus is the relating function, the negative pole of that is out to destroy relationships and destroy you. And it's a destructive force, generally speaking. So you might say that, well, I've got this persona that I really like, so I'm going to wear it all the time because I get people to, you know, come to me and be very interested in me and I like me and stuff like that. But then what you do is you attract lots of things to yourself that are not true to you. You fall into so many traps with that. And by true to you, it's kind of like, well, what happens if you find yourself in an environment that people are brought to you because of your persona, but then you drop the persona? Will people still like you? In which case you're now stuck in a bit of a serotonergic puddle there in
not
terms
good.
Of status and pain. No, not good.
And
not
that's going to reinforce an over-identification with a persona once those ideas start coming. and then further and further away from your base personality.
Yes.
I think that was such, it's such a good warning from Jung, and so applicable now, obviously. Can you speak more about like, what is a 20-year-old to do? I mean, not even 20, mate. I mean, I'm 26 and a lot of my fucking mates are addicted to their public personas. Yeah. You know, to the point where, but basically, what would you say to this person? Like, how can you move away from this over-identification with the persona? Is it a case of just being more authentic in your public personas? Like, is it literally a case of that? Or does it have to be just stop identifying with these social medias who are just proliferating personas that might not actually be close to your personality?
I think people naturally respond to authenticity. So I think if you're going to create, say, a public profile, authenticity without being stupid and revealing too much about yourself to someone who might want to destroy you is probably go with that. Mm-hmm. But then it gets complicated because obviously there's a psychodynamic reason behind why you are over-ampering your persona. And that then requires, so the way in for any of this psychodynamic work really, and it's a relatively safe exercise, especially if you follow the videos of public on the YouTube channel, is to do your own personal myth, to discover your own personal myth. That will reveal a lot because you could be over-amping your persona for a multitude of different reasons.
Yeah.
There are some that cluster more than others. But on the social media front, it's interesting because I was thinking just then as you were talking about how the anima can operate autonomously to a man. And so if you're identified with your persona, and which is a fairly narcissistic thing to do, then you've got your anima that will start to operate away from the ego. You're not wedded to it. It's doing its own mm-hmm. thing. And you have no idea what it's setting up. This is the thing, it will set up, the negative part will set up traps for yourself. It's like, well, that's in many ways, it's the same thing with a social media profile. Imagine like a Twitter profile. Mm. You can have that operates autonomously to yourself too. So to yourself, it might not actually have an effect, at least not immediately. We don't, you know, have these platforms been around for a while? Have we done the studies on it? I don't know, but I personally can't do that.
Right.
I know from personal experience, I tried Twitter for a while. And obviously in the very, very, very beginning, I did overamp a persona. That was not deliberate. That was just, you know, like, as you were saying, lots of young guys do that. But I ended up getting sick, really sick.
Mate, do you ever peruse Twitter these days?
Like I have been recently to keep up with some of the election stuff, but okay. I don't follow any personality.
I've recently really detached myself from it. Throughout COVID have spent, you know, just a lot of time because Twitter is cheap. It's cheap dopamine and it's great cheap dopamine. You know, like you can while you're hitting it, it's nice. But now you've just mentioned this, a lot of the based Twitter, there is a ridiculous over-identification with their based persona, their hyper masculine, you're a pussy if you eat soy once in your life, like personas. And you bring up authenticity. And I think I'm watching we've watched the rise, and I think I'm watching a little bit of the fall of a lot of these big like base Twitter accounts because people are just starting to, like, the authenticity's lost. It started off very authentic because, I mean, maybe even similar to JBP, a similar life cycle. It starts off with these great messages that no one else is saying, that is too un-PC to say anywhere else. And you're like, great, you know, cool. What a cool guy, you know? Oh, he deadlifts really heavy and he's got big abs. Cool. You know, I like this guy, you know? And then you keep following and you're like, oh, this isn't a real person. You know, this is a fake persona that they're trying to sell. And then people feel cheap when it's like, and now buy my book. You know, it always is just like, so I've just taken it off in a bit of a tangent there. And I do want to ask you one more thing. I'm afraid we don't have enough time. So see how quickly you can comment on this for me if you don't mind. Right. Authenticity. Why is it? Taleb talks a lot about authenticity as well. And he has a very good explanation of why it just resonates so well. Is there any sort of Jungian basis for why we are so attached to authenticity, even if it's lower quality and, you know, like less insightful?
Well, authenticity, first of all, doesn't necessarily, I know you didn't say this, but it doesn't necessarily mean no persona, 2021 watching. Mm-hmm. Authenticity is a multi-pronged word. And if you're talking to someone, you're looking at the landscape of fellow men, and you're like, well, who should be my, or unconsciously, you're going, who should be my friend? you're going to probably go for the authentic individual, unless you mean you might not, because you might have issues with status. Mm-hmm. So you might go to a bunch of lads who are like high status, so you can, you know, you can try and confirm yourself. Yep. If you're sort of in a stage where you'd quite like a band of, you used the Grail Knight metaphor earlier, that you quite like a band of Grail Knights, are all, you're all on the same level as each other, going out to help find the Grail with each other. It's like, well, you want an authentic person because they're not going to stab you in the back.
Mm-hmm.
They're stable, and you can see that their performance over time graph is constant. Mm-hmm. And it's good, and it's up. You know, I would say
it's like an evolutionary, I think it's purely social dynamics.
Yeah, so yeah. It's just purely social dynamics. There's far less variables and complications with something like that. And then in yourself as well, why would you want to be authentic? Well, again, even just taking that same argument, it's like, well, you have higher consciousness of yourself, so you're less likely to do stupid things and to go towards things that are a waste of time and a waste of energy. And I don't mean in terms of good habits versus bad habits. I mean genomic resources. You know, it is a complicated field, but we are looking to, in ourselves, become the most authentic version of ourselves. Mm-hmm. And that's identical in many ways to the idea of the genomic self, releasing lifespan potential across your personal myth from the moment you were conceived right the way through to your, unfortunately, but final teleology at the very end of life.
Yeah,
you know, it's finding out who we are.
This life.
Become who you are. You know, that's the tagline of Young to Live By. It's become who you are. So, well, amazing. That's authentic to me.
Amazing. And by the way, I will say this in the introduction, but I'm stoked that you've made Young to Live By, because it's just, there isn't content like that out there. That's accessible unless you are like yourself and just super hyper intelligent and can tackle original texts. You know, personally, I can't really tackle philosophical texts and take that much insight out of them. Whatever. But basically, yeah, I think I'm super long Young to Live By. If I could invest in it, I would be all in, because there is a hotbed of demand for this stuff. And as it stands right now, very limited supply. So really good stuff.
Thank
on that.
You.
Let's finish off this one. And this one, I was watching your personal myth video. And there was a moment there and I was like, oh my God, like I'm having a physiological reaction to this. My heart rate increased, my chest really tightened, and I got really anxious. I got really anxious because you were talking about how you, as a part of the depth, you were talking about how you draw a line throughout your experience. And you try to figure out how close to this line of experience you actually are right now. Okay. And I was like, oh, fucking hell. I am not who I think I am, especially when I look at who I have been in the past. And it did freak me out a bit. But I came back and I realized that I feel like I am doing exactly what I should be doing. And I am who I should be. And it might have just been in the past. It was severe peaks and troughs from the baseline.
Yeah.
So anyway, I had this reaction to it and it got me thinking, like the reason why I am doing this podcast, it's very early days, by the way. I mean, as I'm sure you saw, but basically the reason why I'm doing it is because I want to spread the message of doing something along your path, because everyone has their own path. And this is a bit of an anecdote, and bear with me if it's too wordy, but I was on a bus in Albania and I was listening to this fantastic podcast between Jocko Willink and Tim Ferriss, and they were just breaking down Musashi, Way of the Warrior. And this book, I'm not sure if you're familiar, but people, if you're listening, if you're not familiar with it, it's just the story of a man whose entire being was dedicated to being the greatest swordsman of all time and absolutely unwavering in this pursuit, completely unwavering. And it makes for some hilarious like interactions, because you're like, oh my God, this man is just unbelievable. But and it's supposedly a real story as well, which is the other thing. But at the end of this, Tim Ferriss is there and he is a very accomplished person. And they were talking about this Musashi, and like Jocko obviously had this. When you're in the army and you're fighting, the goal is so singular and every part of your being is going to achieve that. He's felt this and he could really resonate with it, and Tim really couldn't. But he said, if you asked me what my path is, I wouldn't be able to tell you, but I can definitely tell you when I'm not on it.
Yes. Yeah.
And I was like, that was a massive light bulb moment for me, because I was like, oh my God, that's amazing. Because that's exactly how I feel. When I was doing certain things, I feel fantastic about them and I know this is good for me. And then when I do some things, I just know that it's not true to what I'm trying to do. So it's me, part of this podcast is me trying to spread this message. And you know, you have separated from Uber Boyo. You're creating amazing things with Young to Live By, and I'm sure we're going to go down other things. So you've also had this realization, you know? But I just think about a picture of a man at a drawbridge. The drawbridge just runs off into the mist. So there's no end goal. And he's got one plank of wood under his arm. And there's only a few planks on the drawbridge. And that's life. You have this plank, which is what you want to do. You can put it down. You go one step further. You get another plank, you put it down. Maybe you step off because you did something wrong. But it doesn't mean you're dead or anything. It doesn't mean you start again. You just go back to where the bridge was before. That's the purpose. That's the path. You're finding things that just direct you on the path you're meant to be. And so I've just said a lot of words. Do you have anything to say about that?
Yeah. I think that's a really, really good metaphor. And it's, you know, it's humbling. And it's, if I could dilute down the biggest thing that I've learned from my own personal development myth, if you like. So a huge problem I came up against that was then resolved thanks to and wholeheartedly Stephen Pauline Richards, sincerely. And that's what a lot of the stuff on the Young to Live By channel, or all the stuff I should say on the Young to Live By channel and IPSA, comes from those two. So God bless those two. Thank you. I fell into the self-development sphere powerfully, like I was right in it, truly was, and it did nothing, absolutely nothing. You know, because there is a prescription to it. It's like, well, I should be doing the cold showers at 5 a.m. and I must go to the gym because the man goes to the gym, and all this other kind of silliness, and NoFap as well, everything else. Like, is this the answer, is it? Like, all of this stuff is the answer, truly. It's like, no, the attempt to try and build your, so you start obviously with an instinctual, and it's the unconscious then makes it conscious. For myself, that came about with that breakup. It's like, you want to make yourself into a man. And it's like, okay. You then fall into an online group with so many other men who have their own guru of choice, who are trying to do the same thing, top down, make themselves into the best man. Well, what do men do? Let's reverse engineer it and be like, oh, well, I must discipline or something like that. It's like, No, it did nothing. It led to me being, and I've said this publicly on the YouTube channel, chronic death anxiety. We have a dissociative fashion, alcoholic. It's awful, awful time. I crashed and burned.
What should have been this like great time of your life, because you're achieving what you set out to achieve. Yeah.
It should have been. And if you know, if that message of that's how you make yourself into a man be true, then it's like either I failed enormously, or I actually threw myself into it sincerely and truly and saw it for the empty nonsense that it is. It is, you are reverse engineering other people who have succeeded's personal myth and applying it top down to yourself. And that's ignoring you as you are now. And it's ignoring you as you have always been, to the dawn of time, to your first memory, because you're not that person. You are a different person. And so what is the resolution to that? Well, it is truly to return to yourself, because being a man is in every single young man or adolescent boy. It's just waiting to come out, and you don't need to act like somebody else. You were saying earlier with the persona, you don't have to act like somebody else or tack on a good habit or any of this nonsense to become who you are. It's in you. It's biological. We have to emphasize this. It's why we do it. It's in you, and it's released from the genome. Don't follow other people. Follow yourself. It's in you. Just return back to yourself. And, you know, that alleviated so much pain in my life. And, you know, I thank Stephen Pauline sincerely for that. Yeah. I really, really do.
And these days, where are you at now, basically, psychological health-wise?
Well, if you compare myself,
if it's not too invasive of a question, sorry.
Well, you never know how in great shape one is in any one moment in time, but I can tell you, and everyone who knows me, and I think you can see it both in my persona on the YouTube channel and in my appearance on the YouTube channel, It looks like I've aged quite a lot in a more mature way, and this comes from lots of other people. I look
no longer
healthier,
the fresh-faced boyo.
well, that was it. It's like I was a fresh-faced boyo, but also you can see I look a little bit sick in some of those Ion videos because I was recording some of this stuff.
Right.
Just it was a few months before, so the Ion series ended a few months before. You know, the hell happened to me, you could say. But you know, I can say all of those symptoms are, or at least appear to be, gone, completely gone.
And, amazing.
You know, I don't want to make a declaration about that because you can never be sure what's, you know, what the unconscious mind is playing a game with you or how your anima has set things up. For example, I'm here, you know, so it's like, that's interesting. You got to be careful, but I'm much, 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 much better. And I feel like this is where I'm meant to be. And that's a true gift. It really, really is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can't express my gratitude for Stephen Pauling enough. I sincerely can't.
James, it's amazing to hear. It's amazing to hear. I wonder if because, and this is maybe too much flattery, but you're clearly quite an overachiever, right? I mean, you're 24. And have, you know, a lot to show for 24 years. There is, I imagine, a ridiculous pressure for someone who is generally overachieving but sets really high standards for themselves.
Mm.
You know, like, it's almost explicable that things don't exactly work out the way they do. I'm thinking of Israel Adesanya, who you might be familiar with, but he's a Nigerian, New Zealand guy, probably one of the world's best fighters. And he spoke about like the overnight fame that you get, which he got. And he was speaking to sports psychologists and he's like killing it, you know? He's riding, he's psychologically super healthy. And when all of this stuff come, he was prepared for it. And it's like yourself, you know, just young man with a lot of ideas, all of a sudden a bunch of people are recognizing you and, you know, you're achieving all these things and you're looking around you and the other 23-year-olds are just, you know, they're like into their fourth porn that day. You're like, okay, interesting. I can just imagine that's a lot to deal with. And it's almost, at this point, I'm sort of just talking, by the way. I mean, I don't know if that's, if anything I'm saying is worth much, but I mean, I only just met you an hour or two ago, so forgive me, but I suppose that's what happens if you speak to someone for long enough, you start to feel very comfortable. But I don't know.
You might say that is the positive anima flowing with good relating. Thank you though. I think that's very insightful.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I'm from the outside, you know, you might say that I've achieved a few things. They're discrete things. You can name them and it's like, okay, that's good. But from my perspective, it's like, okay, I've done the biology route and then I jumped ship from that. And I've did the boyo thing and I jumped ship from that. And I've jumped ship from several other things along the way as well.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been a rapid pace. It's been incredibly engaging, but I'm still very, very, very much learning.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I am so definitely a work in progress without a shadow of a doubt.
Yeah.
You know, I can help, you know, I've dedicated myself to just building this, say, educational resources with IPSA and Young to Live By, but also sincerely to help people and alleviate suffering. I find that truly engaging. And I learned that through personal myth work. Stephen Pauling guided me through it. And I realized I have always been a depth psychologist in the broadest terms. Every time I sit down with a friend, it would be, tell me about your problems, and then we try and resolve it.
Really?
That's where the libido would always go to since I was very, 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 very small.
Yeah,
I'm still very, very, very much a work in progress. You know, there is a long, long, long way to go.
Yeah.
It's a very engaging journey, and I do appreciate your kind words, though. Thank you, my friend.
James, sincerely, thank you very much. I really...
I've sincerely really enjoyed this, and I wish you the best of success with your podcast. I have a feeling our paths will cross again in the future, but we shall see about that. That'll
yes.
Very exciting.
We shall see. Thank you, sir. Have a good day, and we'll see you later.
Cheers, dude. Take care.
Bye.